You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So it's my pleasure to introduce Fatima Ibrahim, who's just about to come onto the stage. She has many accolades. I'm going to read a few of them out before she comes on. So she is a climate activist and social justice activist. She's worked for AVAS, if you've heard of that, it's a global NGO, the EU Citizens Movement. She's one of the organisers of the People's Climate March, and she supports UK Youth Climate Action. Can we give her a massive round of applause, please?
Hello. So wonderful to be here. And I was here for the conversation that happened just prior to this and just deeply inspired by, the new generation of young people taking the charge and, you know, safeguarding our planet, but also giving other young people pathways to take action. And that's kind of how I got started in taking action on climate change, but actually more fundamentally social justice, making sure that people and planet are able to both live in harmony, but that we center justice in the way that we organize ourselves. So I'm Fatima Ibrahim. I am the co-founder and co-executive director of a movement called Green New Deal Rising. We organize young people between the ages of 16 and 35, a national movement organizing for a Green New Deal, which is a response to the climate crisis that really is rooted in justice. And much of my work, I haven't always worked on climate change, but I definitely have done, you know, almost exclusively for the last decade, is making sure that the climate conversation isn't held separately or the solutions for it imagined separately to our response to inequality, to racism, to migration, to the ways that we build a better future for all of us. And for that reason, I'm really grateful to the Pickwell Foundation and family for hosting this 10 and actually asking me to come and speak about climate and migration, which is something I think we don't talk enough about. It's migration is something as progressives that we're too scared to touch, that we're like, oh, we've kind of left it to the domain of the right because we're so scared to engage with this very kind of fundamental part of human history, which is moving. People have always moved since the beginning of time. And so I guess my question to everyone is, thinking about your own personal history, it can be your own lifetime, but also your ancestors. How many people in this room have, or in this tent, I should say, have a migration story that features somewhere in their ancestry? Yeah, I mean, that's the vast majority of people, because that is our history. We have moved to find better futures for ourselves. We've moved for love. We've moved for education. We've moved because we're unsafe where we are. And this moment we find ourselves in is not very different from that, except it's being exacerbated by the climate crisis. So before I get started, and this is going to be a conversation, the reason I'm not standing on the stage is I'm definitely not worthy of standing on a stage talking to you about this topic. I definitely want it to be a conversation. And it's something, you know, I'm a climate activist. I don't do much work on migration, but my climate activism is so deeply intertwined with my experience of migration. I'm sure you can hear my accent. Despite living in Northwest London since I was 9 years old, I haven't gotten rid of this accent. I was born in Canada and migrated to the UK at the age of 9. My mum moved as a student to the UK in the early 80s, then moved to Canada for love, and then moved back to the UK to be able to access the support of her family who was here to help raise her children. And so I've always found my identity and home in, you know, wherever, you know, not just in the UK, not just in my local community, but actually I'm able to find home most places because from an early age, I have felt that the world is my home. And I have always felt in community with people who are globally minded and internationalist. And so the way I came to climate activism is this connection with people around the world and witnessing conflict and witnessing, you know, in the early 2000s, the war on terror and what was happening in Iraq and what was happening in Afghanistan and really feeling like my future was tightly bound with those people. And as I grew up and learned more, thinking that actually it's climate change is the biggest threat to humans. And if I love humans and my commitment to this is to make sure that we're able to safeguard people's human rights and humanity, then we really had to tackle the climate crisis. So in many ways, my journey here has been one that has been fueled by migration. But before I start, I want us to all be able to tap into our own humanity, because I think being able to find empathy and the courage to engage in a conversation about migration is about, I think, tapping into our own feelings and the things that we're scared about and what it would look like for us to be in a precarious position before we get to the next stage, which is having empathy with other people, both in our communities and people we might never meet. So I'm going to ask everybody to close their eyes for a couple of minutes, and I'm going to get you to imagine something for me. So I'm going to ask you to imagine that after this talk is done, you're going to be told you can't go home again. That the home that you left behind is not a place you're going to be able to return to for a while. Imagine what you've left behind. Who are the people you've left behind? What are the things that you've left behind? What did you bring with you? Do you have enough to figure things out? Do you know where you would go next? Who would you contact? Do you think you could earn a living? What emotions does this bring up? Okay. That, I want us to sit with that feeling, and what I'm going to ask us to do, and I hope you'll indulge me, is turn to someone next to you, introduce yourself, say, tell them your name, tell them where you've come from actually as also, and then tell them how you're feeling. And it's fine, it can just be a word, but just tell them how you're feeling. Okay, I'm going to give us a couple of minutes. All right, I'm going to call you all back. I feel bad about doing that because I love that everybody's having conversation. Yeah, if I actually want to hear that. So you, here, how did that feel?
It felt absolutely horrible.
Yeah, I bet it did. Anybody else, what came up for them?
I was actually based with that one.
I really want people to hear this.
Sorry,
I'm just not
wanting to take.
Oh, great! Yeah, please.
Yeah, I was faced with that question a week last Thursday, because probably about 300 meters from where we lived, there was a huge fire with a disused care home, and it was like myself and my 18-year-old daughter. We were like, what should we take away? So I literally got two passports. She was like, photos off the wall, and it was like mobile phone. Thankfully, it was slightly raining that night, so it wasn't the issues. But again, with the summer that we've been having, it's been pretty horrendous. Yeah. So, I mean, that was a genuine fear, and the smell of smoke and all of that. So,
I'm really glad you guys are okay. And that's the crux of it. I mean, this summer, we're asking ourselves questions we never thought we'd have to ask, right? Like, climate change is something that we thought, you know, yeah, is impacting this island, but really wouldn't dramatically change our lives for at least another decade, another two decades. But this summer, I mean, it sounds dramatic, but when I sat over there, my friend was sending me a message. She's a great prepper. She was the one who essentially really cottoned onto the fact that COVID-19 was going to become a big thing. And like, we didn't listen to her, so we try and listen to her now. But she's like, listen, things are becoming more unstable. I would really suggest that you pack go bags. And that's just even receiving that message and knowing, I mean, that's not the first time I've heard that this summer, actually, is a terrifying reality. But we know that that has always been a reality for people in other parts of the world. So climate migration, when we think of that and the image that comes to mind, or at least the image that is particularly seeded in Britain and in Europe, is a vision of an enormous amount of people rushing towards our borders, right? We imagine those people being from countries in Africa, in Asia, from Pacific Islands, and it feeds a particular story that the climate crisis is getting worse, though often the people seeding these stories don't even believe in climate change, which is peculiar, but that climate is getting worse, that our countries are going to become more unstable, that our communities are going to face more scarcity, and that millions of people will move and they will be rushing towards our shores. And that's the story that I want to challenge, because it gets a lot wrong about the links between climate change and migration. Climate is absolutely going to force more people to move. Floods are going to destroy homes. I mean, I'm sure everyone will have seen what has happened in Nepal and the devastating impact it has had on those communities, along with the wildfires we've seen all summer. We're so used to seeing wildfires in Australia and on the western coast of the US, but now it's been happening both in this country and just across the channel. Droughts will destroy crops. We know we're going to have a really terrible harvest this year, and we're going to face those food impacts. But again, we're going to be seeing that globally. Sea levels will rise and threaten communities. But the equation is never as simple as climate impact, disaster, people move. It hardly ever happens that way. It does in really extreme circumstances, and that's when we see it on the news. But climate is actually just a pressure multiplier. So the conversation that I'm going to begin us on right now is, why is it every time that we talk about climate and migration, it centers European borders, when actually most of the migration that is happening due to climate, and actually whether it's climate or conflict, isn't happening across European borders. It's happening within countries and across one border, which is people staying in the regions that they are originally from. And this becomes a question of who gets to move. Under what conditions do they get to move? What choices do they have? Are they forced? Are they forced to stay? Is that fair? Should we, what would be a climate justice response that allows people to stay with dignity or to move with dignity? So the first myth is climate migration means millions of people coming here. So I've already started to talk about this. There's a stat that gets thrown about a lot from the World Bank that says by 2050, 216 million people will move as a result of climate change. That sounds like, that's scary. That's a lot of people. You know, when you just look at that number, you're like, that's a lot of people moving. There's a lot of people moving because of an impact and running for safety. But the World Bank, when it projected that number, wasn't projecting international migration. It was projecting internal displacement. People moving from one city to another, people moving from rural communities to cities, something that we know happens both in this country. I mean, how many people have left their communities and after university moved to a city? Like, yeah. I mean, a lot of people do that. The other stat that's really interesting that gets stripped out of this is the World Bank also says strong action to bring down emissions and mitigate climate change can stop 80% of that movement. So even that stat is not a destiny. It's linked to a choice we have. Whether we take this oncoming crisis seriously enough to take action, and it is a political choice whether we take action, whether our leaders actually want to prioritize tackling the climate crisis, or whether they want to prioritize lining their own pockets and the pockets of corporations and fossil fuel companies, or whether we get ahead of this. And we not only tackle the climate crisis, but we also deal with the heart of why we feel like there is scarcity, right? Because we actually do have enough. For every feeling of scarcity we have, and I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, it's fundamentally linked to a political choice. And that scarcity is due to hoarding, whether it's wealth, whether it's land hoarding, whether it's fossil fuel giants taking massive profits, which drive our energy bills up. I mean, I don't blame people in communities who feel like they don't have enough. They don't have enough. Living standards have not improved in our country since 2008. That's nearly two decades that people's living standards have not improved. And that's not because GDP hasn't gone up. That's not because people haven't gotten rich. We've created more billionaires in that time than any time before. And so where is that money going? This is my tangent. This actually wasn't in here, but I just, at the heart of this is that that's what I want you all to know, is that where the hope, like there's so many reasons to be fearful. And like, I'm in the stage of my life where I want to embrace that feeling of fear. That fear is not the opposite to hope. It can live alongside it. But the hope comes from the fact that we still have a choice. Eminem playing in the background is epic. So the UNHCR also makes this point, the UNHCR, which is the UN entity responsible for refugees. And they also make this point about most of the migration that they're dealing with is internal migration. I think one of the biggest stories around people moving that has happened in our recent lifetime is the war in Syria. The numbers of people that had to flee the Assad regime and what was happening in Syria, there was such a like massive political conversation around those who were making it to the our European shores, right? Like how many people are making it to Europe? When the truth and what that was hiding is the vast majority of Syrians actually either stayed in Syria or went to neighboring countries in Turkey and Lebanon. And we weren't having a global conversation about how do we support neighboring countries to provide housing and care for those. But instead, we were kind of having a meltdown about those who are making it to Europe. And I guess the point is like there is a political reason we're centering European borders, and it's to fuel this idea of scarcity, because scarcity and communities who are scarce feel like they have less options, and communities who have less options make political choices that are reactionary, and reactionary political choices empower those who have the most to benefit from extracting from our communities. That's why we're seeing Farage rise. That's why we're seeing Le Pen rise. That's why we're seeing the ADF and Trump rise, right? Is that their currency is scarcity. They actually only win in a world where they've convinced us that we don't have enough. Because actually, the minute that we feel like we have enough, people do make better political choices. They suddenly humanize their neighbors. They suddenly feel like, oh, we can make communal choices that like benefit all of us and not just me. Okay, so another story I want to tell you about climate impacts not being a linear reason why people move is about a story of a woman called Asha in Somalia. So Somalia is a region or a country in the world that my family is from that has been ravaged by both climate impacts and conflict, and is experiencing, you know, a severe drought now, but has done for years, right? So it's not that the drought ends. It's just, you know, another, you know, crop failure again, year after year. It's become a key feature of the geography. She was living in a region in Somalia that had experienced these massive droughts, and they faced the first year of crop failures, then another year, then the animals that they were herding died, and then in the small town where they would go to the market to get stuff, you know, came militants, and then therefore they couldn't access the market safely. Then her child got sick, then her husband died, and that then forced her to move to another region, to move to a big city, where she heard that the UN was providing aid and support. So in many ways, that example, you could say she is a climate migrant, but it wasn't just the drought. It was the way that the drought multiplied all the other insecurities in her life. And that's how many people experience climate change, right? And so this is why, in many ways, we don't have legal language for climate migration, because it's hard to pinpoint it and to define it from an economic migrant, someone who's left conflict, someone who's a refugee in the way that it's defined in the Refugee Convention. We're living in a world why why people move are actually not as simple as defined in the post-1945 Refugee Convention. And so this is to say that there currently isn't any legal language or legal protection for people who are displaced because of climate change. The second thing I want to say is there's a myth, or at least a feeling, that migration means something has gone wrong. And I've already said this, people have moved since the beginning of time, but you know, moving is also an adaptation. It could actually be the response to adapting to the climate crisis in the way that it's been an adaptation to technology, in the way that it's been an adaptation to jobs. And there's lots of research to show that actually people leaving their communities and moving, you know, further enriches the communities that they've left behind, because they work, they send money back, they come back, they bring skills, they come back, they educate people in their communities. And so moving as an adaptation is actually something that we need to be thinking about in how we tackle the climate crisis. Another example I want to talk about is, and I almost loathe to bring this up as an example because it includes a country that has a wretched migration policy that in many ways the UK has sought to model, which is Australia. Australia is one of the first countries to pilot and successfully use offshore detention and to ban people from ever settling in Australia based on how they got to the country. But they do have an agreement with Tuvalu, which is one of the islands, near Pacific islands near them, that will severely be impacted by climate change and rising sea levels. And they call it a program around mobility with dignity. So it is a climate adaptation, recognizing that eventually people in Tuvalu might have to leave their island. And so every year they allow 280 Tuvaluans to get permanent settlement in Australia. That's about 3% of the population. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but there's only 10,000 people in the island of Tuvalu to begin with. And to me, that's an interesting idea of how we plan for the future and don't wait for impacts, but give people time to plan, to move back and forth, to give them access to be able to build and think about how they take and maintain their cultures. Because one of the things that impacts the climate change will do is like, it will destroy not just where people live, but then by virtue, their cultures and their ties to land and their language. And so I just wanted to use that example of there are political solutions to this problem that center dignity and justice. And that is a very small example of how Tuvalu and Australia are working together to make sure that people can start to move and plan for the future. I normally always have my passport on me, and it's because I'm an adult who doesn't drive, and therefore it's one of my forms of ID. Also because the lady who works at the Tesco near my house has something against me and IDs me for everything. So, but I don't have it with me right now, and I wanted to use it as a prop because our passports are going to become and are already one of the most important parts of climate infrastructure, right? One of the things that protects us is our citizenship. Whether we can move across borders safely, whether we're welcome, whether we have the choice to move, where we have the choice to move. I'm one of those very lucky people who is both a Canadian citizen and a British citizen. So much of the world is open to me. But even with that citizenship, we are starting to see the meaning of what it means to belong being politically chipped away at. And so post 2003, governments started to put limits on citizenship. And we are seeing in the UK, actually, one of the things that barely gets coverage is that the UK government is stripping citizenship from people with no public oversight, with no judicial oversight, right? Based on whether they feel like that person is a threat to the British public and making them stateless. And obviously the most important case or the most high profile case of this has been Shamima Begum. And I think what I have found really sad is to see a limited progressive pushback to the idea that someone can have their citizenship stripped from them. Because what that opens a window to is a world where we face more scarcity and the state has the power to lock people out. And suddenly we have two-tier citizenship, where if you're British enough, if you're white enough, if you've been here enough generations, your British citizenship is more entrenched than mine. And so the reason I use that as an example is why we need to talk about migration and why we need to center those who don't have a choice and who have less powerful passports and who are being forced to move, that rather than choosing to move, is eventually we will end up on the firing line. If no other reason, we can already see that we've normalized a world in which we build fortresses and lock people out, but we're now building fortresses within our own countries, where two people who are born in the same city, in the same hospital, one of them is more British than the other. And we're not that far away from a point in which one of those two people could have their citizenship stripped away. And they are no longer have a state. They no longer have a place of belonging. And so passports are already a piece of infrastructure that give us safety and give us choices, but those choices are getting narrower and narrower. So I think when we think about this, we kind of have to think about two things at the same time. There are people who have less choices than us, and we need to protect them. But by not protecting them, we can see how the politics of the right is moving further. They're not satisfied at keeping people who are outside out. They will come and try and build walls around our own communities to keep people already inside and push them out. One of the final, and then I do want this to open up into a conversation, just a few more points, is that we've talked a lot about movement, but movement is also a privileged choice, right? To be able to move. So the lady here who was talking about potentially having to flee her house, right? You were thinking about what you could take. You had access to a car, maybe? What is the safest? And even that, even in that distressing moment, like surveying the options, in this country that we're in, there would have been options potentially for you, right? Many people don't have the option to move at all because they don't have the resources, they don't have the passport that I said, they don't have anywhere else to go. They think about the most vulnerable people in your life. They might not even be mobile enough to leave, right? And I mean, not to kind of take us to a really sad place, but I live in London, and I was at Ladbroke Grove the other day, and I could see, I thought I was imagining it, but I could almost see the outline of the old Grenfell Tower that is no longer there on the horizon. And if you'll remember back in 2017, Grenfell, where we watched, you know, nearly 80 people burn alive in their block of flats because of the negligence of those developers who kind of put cladding that was not fire safe. To me, that was, again, an opportunity for us to realize, like, there are people in those blocks of flats who couldn't leave. They weren't mobile enough to leave. I remember a story of a family where the children couldn't carry their parents out, but they also didn't want to leave their parents. So they all perished together. That choice and that conversation is happening all the time. And there were lots of migrants and people who didn't have papers who also died in that building who are not counted as part of the total, because they were illegal migrants. And so there's microcosms of this global crisis happening even in our own communities, and it would do us a lot of good to look for them and remind ourselves of them and just see how that's being replicated everywhere. And so, yeah, so to move is a privilege. It's not a privilege, but to move means you have the ability to move. To move means that you're probably poor and don't have the resources to. So what does that say about the response that we need? There are two political realities. There's the one political reality which we're currently on track for, which is a political reality of fortresses, where every country and every community becomes an island. We just build the wall, as Trump says. We just build it. We keep people out. We hoard as much as we can for ourselves. And then when we don't have enough, we kick a few more people out and we keep building. That's one political reality. And like, by no means am I kidding when I say that is the one that we're on track for. The second political reality is one based in justice and one based in climate justice. And that is to recognize that we live in a radically unequal world. The countries and the communities who contributed the least to the climate crisis are often experiencing its impacts first and the hardest. So our responsibility is to make people's lives safer. That means actually tackling the climate crisis. Cutting emissions, it means adaptation finance, it means tech transfer so countries can start building solutions for themselves to stay. It means debt justice and making sure, you know, till this day we have colonial debt systems that have, you know, countries still paying so much for money that they borrowed to develop. And the only reason that they're developing in the way that they are is because we've plundered their communities to begin with. It means disaster protection. It means decent jobs. It means social protection. So, and it means safe routes. So the principle really at the heart of all of this is giving people dignity in moving and dignity in staying. So we need to have safe pathways for people to move if they need to move, and dignified ways for them to protect themselves and stay if they want to stay. And the vast majority of people do want to stay in the countries that they're from, with the communities that they grew up with the people that they share languages with the history that they identify with. And I had a friend of mine say to me, as the crisis, you know, as the genocide's been unfolding in Gaza, she said, you know what, it never occurred to me that people could have such a attachment to a piece of land. And I said, because your land has never been under threat, because you've never been forced to leave it. Your culture has never been one that hasn't been the hegemonic culture. And so yes, like people don't want to, like people do feel a connection to where they've been from, to the cultures and communities and to the people that they have buried there. And so that's essentially what I wanted to share with you all. I do want us to, let me see how much time I have, because I do want to open it up a bit. I do want us to do one exercise and then I will do a set of questions. So everyone's been so engaged. The eye contact in this tent is intense. I love it. Everyone looks comfortable and everyone's taking notes. Okay, so my proposition, you know, when I was invited to Greenbelt, this is my first time here, it was described to me as yes, and I will be back. It was described to me as a place that brings people together who are community leaders, people who are deeply committed to the places and communities that they're from, and who are serious about learning and taking action. And so in many ways, I feel like you are the audience and the people that I want to reach. And if some way we can take Hot House back out into the world, we've got a really good chance of doing all the things that we want to do. And so to go back to what I said earlier, I could have come and given you a bunch of organizations to follow. You will, I think there's lots of people who are here who will tell you about their organizations to sign up. I'm gonna do something slightly different. There are lots of organizations doing great work. But we live in a moment in time where people are feeling incredibly isolated and lonely. So even when I started doing this work 15 years ago, people were members of clubs, the big organizations, the Greenpeaces, the Amnesties in the world were like present in our communities. There were youth clubs, churches were really active in our community. Like there were just places where you could meet people and make sense of the world together. If you are a young person right now, particularly, but not just a young person, even if you're an older person, the likelihood is you're sat at home on your phone, feeling really lonely and not knowing how you're gonna connect with people, right? There aren't really lots of places you could go and make sense of the world with other people. You're probably feeling really, really scared and not knowing how to communicate that and who to communicate it with. So given that we are community leaders, I'm saying we are all community leaders. We're here. So this is our title, community leaders. Given that we are taking responsibility, and I'm describing your community to you, that there are a lot of people who feel like that. And when you feel alone, one, algorithms are reaching you with scarcity messaging, but you are also probably feeling scarcity because you're not accessing a good job. If you're a young person, you're unlikely to be able to own a home. You're maybe still living at your parents' house. The world is feeling quite small. And then you also knew it was a bit different before, right? Because your parents traveled, they bought homes. They have fantastic stories about what it meant, felt to be young. So you also have that feeling like things were different. That's where Faraj and his mates get the opportunity to tell people something's been taken away from them. So I'm laying the land for you. The other thing I'm going to tell you is, I know for certain, if we can make people feel connected to each other, this is why I got you guys to talk to each other at the beginning, and make them feel like there isn't scarcity, there's actually enough if we band together, that is the thing that's going to open up a wedge in our communities. That means that we feel abundant about the future, we're more likely to not see other humans as enemies, and it will give us the fuel to fight for the future that we want. So, I've just described the lay of the land. You guys are the leaders. What I want you to do is turn to someone next to you and come up with at least one tangible thing you could do in your community that would offer people an opportunity to be less lonely and to feel like they had community. And the scale can be anything. It could be your neighbor. It could be your church or your mosque. Or it could be your street. The scale is up to you. But at least one other person. What is a tangible thing you could do to bring one other person into the fray and make them feel like they're not alone? Okay, that's the task. I'm looking forward to hearing what you come up with. I will give you 5 minutes. I can hear everyone is quietening down, which maybe means people are ready to report back. Okay, 10 seconds. Oh my God. Everyone is so compliant. I love this. This is so easy. Everyone's doing the exercise I asked them to do. Everyone's stop. Yes. I'm learning. All right. Okay. I would love a couple of people to report back and to inspire us with the different types of actions we could take. So, oh, I said everyone's compliant. Now no one's going to put over there. Raise your hand if you want to report back. Yes.
Hiya. Hi. So I've recently moved to a small town in the South Wales Valleys. And maybe I can see whether there's like a art and crafts group that I could start for like 18 to 35 year olds. I actually have no idea what's in the community at the moment. Maybe it's an opportunity to actually find out what's available as well. But that could be like a really good, like I could just have free tea and coffee and biscuits, because who doesn't want to go to a place that's got free tea, right?
Absolutely.
So yeah, maybe I could just have a look and try and do something like that maybe.
I love that. That's such a brilliant idea and I really want you to do it. And if anyone's from South Wales, find this young lady.
Thank you. Sorry, I'll try and keep this brief, but it's got a bit of backstory. So I'm church leader, and our church has got a massive crack, which has been exacerbated. Well, it's been caused by climate change and by the drying subsidence. And so we're just filling in some forms to try and get grant funding. And one of the things we're looking at is how can we not just fix the church, but develop it as a building. And we're thinking about kitchen space and just within that, obviously. I say hope, obviously, as a church, one of the things we're about is about community building. But if a part of that development is in placing a kitchen in a way that is more usable, then the answer to the question I'm being asked in terms of how is what you're planning giving resilience to climate change is not just, oh, we're making a building that is less likely to fall down, but is actually we're creating a space which can become a hub at which it's much easier for people to come together and to eat.
Yeah. I love that. That on two levels. I think like food is a brilliant way to bring people together. But, you know, whenever anyone has a bit of resources, and sometimes I'm talking to foundations, I'm like, if you can invest in space, that is the most brilliant thing that you can do for social action and communities. Because actually just giving people a space to meet and to turn up, like, does fill you with a sense of resilience and capacity. And that we're not all sort of stuck in our small flats or small homes that we can't invite anyone around to. So I love that. We'll take this and we can do.
Following on from that, I'd like to talk about the village of Titchmarsh, which is very, very near here. Okay. Has a beautiful 15th century church. 15 years ago, it was falling down. And it cost £1 million. So what the church did is it had a community meeting with the community of the village. And they had to decide whether to close the church or to raise £1 million. They decided to raise £1 million. But the key is, it wasn't the church doing it. It was the church and the community together. I think that that's what the church needs to embrace, mm-hmm. actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love that. Churches and places of faith are community infrastructure, and historically where we have felt or found safety and abundance and a place of like sanctuary. So I think that's gorgeous. Okay, I'm going to end us with a Q&A. I'm not really worthy of answering your questions, but let's see. Maybe someone else will answer your question if I can. But it kind of, we've meandered a bit, and I hope you can, this is how my brain works in many ways, is like, climate is connected to so many different things. And for me, when I really boil it down, it's always about justice. And the way that I connect with justice is for me is first actually contemplating on myself and my own kind of fears and emotions about the way the world is maneuvering. And then thinking, okay, what are all the ways that I'm resourced and how would someone more vulnerable sort of navigate this? And so being quite people first, like going back to those who are most impacted. So it doesn't matter what the kind of problem we're facing is, like who are those who are least responsible and most impacted is a tool I always use, whether it's social justice or climate, and contemplating who we need to center first. And then the second thing is remembering that everything is a political choice. It's all to play for. I really do think like we are going to face climate impacts. I'm not telling you that we can stop climate change entirely. Some of those impacts are already here. But how badly we are impacted by them is entirely a political choice. So if you need hope, it's the fact that we have a choice and that we can change the trajectory of humanity if we want to. And then the third thing for me is politics and politicians are downstream from people power. If that we band together, we can force our politicians to do what we want. We can hold corporations accountable. We can build the future that we want. And so I want people to leave this tent and leave Greenbelt feeling like, okay, there's some massive problems on the horizon and the world is going to change and it's going to look fundamentally different and it's going to challenge us. We're going to feel uncomfortable. It's going to be scary at points. But if we connect with each other, if we remember there is enough, it's just being hoarded, we can chart a different path. So on that note, we will open up, and we've still got a decent amount of time for some questions or comments or reflections, but yeah, you.
So as always at Greenbelt, we always say, can you try and keep it brief so that everyone gets a chance? I'll choose a variety of people. If it is a comment, just keep it fairly brief so that we can also have questions, please. So if we have hands up, I'll come out and choose as many people as I can in the time we have left.
Okay.
As you heard, I'm a mum of a 18-year-old, and the employment market's quite different to, you know, how it was when I was 18. With climate justice and everything in mind, obviously there's a lot of large players that are very hard to get jobs for. What would you suggest, or what would you encourage young people to do that have a particular passion, interest in a particular part of climate justice, climate change, and tackling that? What would you encourage them to do?
Two things. This is, it's almost as if I planted you to ask that question, because Green New Deal Rising is actually just in the process of launching our next campaign, which is to deal with youth unemployment crisis and also the attack on climate policies in general for a climate jobs campaign that Andy Burnham really needs to deal with the number of young people who just don't have access either to employment or education or training, and recognize that this is happening at the same time that net zero, which can provide lots of future jobs that we should be skilling up our country for, are being attacked. And so really the heart of that campaign is there's plenty of work to be done to build the future we want. So why are we not giving opportunities to do that? And so please tell them about Green New Deal Rising. But even within our organizing, there's a role for everybody. So if you are someone who loves to take disruptive action and hold political leaders accountable, we've got a role for you. If you're an articulate person who wants to run trainings or do media, we train people to do that. If you are someone who knows how to cook and just wants to share good food with people, we always have camps like this and we service ourselves and we've got really great kitchen teams. If you're someone who's arty and wants to make banners, we've got that. So there's like so many different roles in the movement, and we, Green New Deal Rising, we really try and make a space where people can kind of come as they are and then think about what is the role that they want to play in the movement, because there isn't a singular role that you can play. I think on the employment side, it is, again, political. I think every young person should send their CV to their MP and be like, I want a job building the future. And you can make as many agreements as you want with Sainsbury's, but the future I want to build isn't working stacking shelves, which is dignified work. But that cannot be your answer to an entire generation of people who want to build a secure future. So that's just like one part of my answer to you. But I would say, like, get them to join community, get them to join whatever group that like their interest. It could be an activist group. There's lots of art related groups. There's lots of music groups that are doing work on climate. So I think our movement has become much more diverse over the last decade, and people are organizing around their interests. So I think there's lots of stuff that they can be involved in, especially now that they're 18. I'm getting very warm in this tent. It really is the hot house. Thank you.
Thank you for your really inspiring talk and dialogue. I'm involved in kind of climate activism and migration solidarity activism and community stuff as well, all around both of those. Do you have any advice about being involved in community building of different types and without burning out? Because that is a struggle. It kind of goes in waves. Mm-hmm. And I do keep on going, but there are times when it can feel a lot.
Yeah. It can feel a lot, that like the world is on our shoulders and that the challenge that I've just outlined is something that we have to do alone. I think there's two pieces of advice from someone who's also working my way through it. One is, I've always said this to anyone I organize with, I'm not sacrificing myself for a future I will never experience. I want to build the future while experiencing it too. So like, I really prioritize joy and community and having fun, and like, life doesn't have to be serious and we don't have to self-flagellate and be, you know, this is our fault and we have to feel terrible about it. I don't feel that kind of responsibility, right? The responsibility I feel is about trying to leave a better world and work towards a better world. But I'm not coming to this from a place of shame. I'm not coming to this from a place of like, I must, you know, pay my dues and therefore I must suffer through it. And so if there's any way I can unburden anyone who kind of feels that, like, we shouldn't feel that. We're trying to do our best. And as long as we're doing our best, I think people should enjoy life and you should be a full person and like this not be your only identity. And so that's one of the ways in which I try and not burn out, is like, this isn't the only thing that I do. And this isn't the only thing that I enjoy. And if you meet me out in the wild, I very rarely talk about politics, right? And then the second thing for me is being in community. Like, I've always, you know, I remember when I started doing this work as a teenager, I was just like in awe of all of the people I met. And I was like, I love that I am committed to this work, but more than anything, I love the people that I've met. And I have been friends with the same group of people that I started organizing with at the age of 18 till now, because there's nothing more powerful, and I'm sure if you've been in any community, you've felt this, that like the connection you feel with people that you're aligned with about the future and that you are willing to sacrifice with is probably one of the most powerful and strongest relationships you can ever make. And so I think prioritizing doing this with other people is also a way that you safeguard from burnout, is because you're building community and resilience at the same time. Yeah.
I had a question about economics, and it relates a bit to the employment question of young people. There's a lot of work to be done in building the future, and we need people to do it. And what do you think about the proposition of universal basic income, so that also we sort of decouple this idea of work and salary and status from what needs to be done in society? Yeah.
I mean, I love that. I'm not an economist, and I, like, in many ways an observer like you. But at the same time, the future of work needs to change, particularly for contending with things like AI, right? There is a world in which there is plenty of work to be done, but also less formal work to be done. But we really need to make sure that we think about redistribution and how people can afford life's basics. So actually, the New Economics Foundation has done a bit of work on this that expands on the universal basic income, because that just focuses on the income part of it, but actually universal basic services. Like, what are life's fundamentals that we should all be able to access regardless of income? And I think that, to me, broadens it beyond just like what do we have in our pocket, but it's also what can we access, right? Making sure that we are protecting not just the rights to healthcare, but also access to water, access to housing, like housing being a fundamental right, education being a fundamental right. And that's what I love it as both an economic answer and principle, but also even a narrative principle of like, there is actually enough and we have evidence of it if we focus on redistribution. And I think the economic conversation only focuses on one side of the coin, which is how do you generate? Like, how does our country increase the amount of money it has access to? But we never really have a conversation about, okay, but how do you redistribute that? And currently there is no relationship with the GDP of our country and the living standards of people, right? So we could have a country that gets richer and richer, but the people get poorer and poorer. So really focusing on that redistributive element of like, how do we make sure that, whether it's through a universal basic income, whether it's through a four-day work week, whether it's through universal basic services, that we're protecting those rights. The last tangent I want to go on actually is my gripe with the left and progressives is this obsession with class that is very linked to income. Right? And we see this debate all the time in the papers of, oh, why are the people on 100K complaining? Right? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I think it is a bit rich for someone on a high income to be in the newspapers complaining. Yet, the thing that underlies it for me is, what does your income afford you? Great movements before us, particularly unions, focused on living standards. So it wasn't the income, it's living standards. What does your wage actually earn you? And by focusing solely on wage, we've given up the right to housing and owning a house. We've given up the right to go on holidays. We've given up the right to be able to provide things for our children. Because I'm like, you know, 50K now and 50K 30 years ago, completely different, right? And so I would love for us to really think about living standards. What do we have a right to? What is the life that we're aspiring to as a community, and fight for that? And then the income is like a kind of, you know, it will need to go up, right? Like, we all need to earn more. But if you have people right at the top of the food chain complaining, what do you think about the vast majority of people who are on 30K and below? What can they afford? So anyway, that's my little tangent based on what you said. Yeah.
Final one, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, thank you so much for that talk. My question is an extension of the burnout question you had earlier.
Yeah.
We're on a very personal level. There's a lot of hopelessness that you have to constantly fight to be a climate activist. There's people, the community that I belong to, there's a lot of people being, oh, well, it's here now. What more are we going to do? You could do all the paper straws and the compostables, and then you have a billionaire take a jet out, for an evening? And then have you ever faced that no matter how much we do, there's going to be those people who can do just in one evening, undo or worsen us and set us so much back? Yeah. And then in times like those, do you have like a mantra or do you have advice for us? What's your thought process?
Yeah. So my relationship with individual action has been, in the pie chart of action, individual action is 20%, political action is 80%, right? And so I think it's helpful for us to all try and do better and live more in line with sustainability and also just like start living the way that we're going to have to live in the future, which is consume less. But in terms of action, the thing that has sizable day and night action is political action. And so if I were feeling like that, I would think about where am I putting my emphasis? Am I really trying to perfect individual action? Or am I taking political action? Because the beautiful thing about political action is quite often we're failing. But when we're winning, it can be quite seismic, right? And so you could do a lifetime of fighting, but it just... And if you think a bit about Greta Thunberg, who started off just as a young girl who was outside of the Swedish, you know, government building, sitting there every week. And then immediately it became this global kind of movement. And in the UK, at least in 2019, you know, seemingly overnight, because of the climate strikes, the government declared a climate emergency. We had net zero. They established some citizens' assemblies. Like, that is, in many ways, seismic political action, right? That you can do if you organize politically. And so that's why I don't lose hope, is like, if we build movements big enough, if we have protests big enough, if we build leverage that's big enough, we can actually, like, supercharge the action in the same way that a billionaire's decision can also be seismic. I think we can have the sort of alternate push. Yeah.
Thank you. So we've learned we're all community leaders, and we're going to leave being community leaders.
Yes.
Massive round of applause, please. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.